Hi, this is Richard Edelman, and you're listening to The Trust Makers.
Hi, I'm Amanda Edelman, COO of the Gen Z Lab and Deputy Lead of EMEA's Client Portfolio at Edelman. 2024 has been a year full of elections. More than half of the world's population has gone to the polls. Now, we're less than a week away from the U.S. election. One voting bloc candidates and pundits are focused on Gen Z, the youngest generation eligible to vote. So, what do younger voters want from this election and from government more broadly? To help answer that question, I'm joined by Joe Vogel, a member of the Maryland House of Delegates and a Gen Zer himself. Joe, welcome to the Trustmakers.
It's so good to be here.
So first question is a little bit about your background and your motivations. So I'd love to understand what motivated you to pursue your own political career. From what I know, you've been politically active since you were in high school, working on a number of campaigns and in Capitol Hill. So what made you want to get involved in politics?
I think it was an extreme sense of frustration with what we were seeing in this country. We are a generation that grew up in what is now known as the school shooting generation, right? Experiencing tragedy after tragedy after tragedy in every school across the country and in the minds of every single young person growing up in that generation, a real sense of fear. We grew up knowing that our generation was going to face the greatest consequences, be that first generation to face the greatest consequences of the climate crisis, and a sense of urgency on that issue. And that led me to saying, you know what, I want to be part of the solution here. I don't want to be frustrated anymore. And that is part of what led me on this journey.
When we launched the Gen Z Lab in 2022, it was off the back of a report that we published at the end of 2021, what we called the power of Gen Z. And our biggest finding is that Gen Z deeply craves safety and security. They have this visceral need for safety and security. And we were so shocked by the findings of this report. And so many of our clients were absolutely shocked. But obviously, hearing from you directly, it's no surprise. To your point, particularly in the US, there's school shootings, there's climate change, all of this sort of fear really came through our data. Obviously, it's something that's still really, really present. And so I'm curious, how do you feel like this sort of concern and this fear has influenced your platform and things that you're advocating for?
I think it shapes the issues that I take on for sure. But also, I'm the youngest legislator right now in the state of Maryland. So I take that as a great responsibility of making sure that an entire generation of young people is well represented in our government, even people that are, you know, significantly younger than I am, who have had an extremely different experience growing up, even than I did myself. So one of the things that I've done is go to schools and have town halls with young people. And, you know, anytime that I see a group of young people around the legislature, I come over to them, introduce myself. You know, they get excited and I start listening. And this was right after I had been elected. And this is one of the most shocking moments of my time in public office was this town hall that I did with student government leaders from all the high schools in the county that I represent. And I would say that of 300 people in the room, you know, 25 of them came and asked questions. I would say 20 of the 25 questions were about student mental health, right? So I think that also ties back to the point that we're making here. There are real urgent crises that are facing our young people, whether it be the impact that social media is having on their day-to-day lives, whether it be crisis of mental health and how that's affecting young people in so many different ways, whether it be what we're seeing now, a rise in the number of overdoses amongst young people, right? We have a number of different challenges, and I bring this perspective on all the different issues that we touch, saying, okay, how does this impact young people and how do we make sure that young people are being supported here? So I'll give you a quick example here on the overdose epidemic, specifically on the rise in fentanyl overdoses that we're seeing right now. We still don't have enough youth treatment facilities. So that's been my focus. Yes, let's get more treatment facilities generally. Let's get more rehabilitation facilities. But let's make sure that young people also have those resources. And along those lines, Narcan, naloxone, which we know is a life-saving medication for young people, or for all people who are experiencing an overdose. Young people came to me, students at some local high schools, and said, hey, we're getting in trouble in our school for carrying Narcan and naloxone. So these are the kind of issues that I work on, informed not just by my own personal experiences, but by those that are raised to me by young people.
But I have two questions off the back of what you've just said. The first is some of the issues that you've talked about. It seems that there is a bit of a divide between your priorities, which reflect the issues facing young people today, and what I would call maybe the legislative status quo. I'm really curious how you see this showing up in the presidential election, and in particular, what you view as the priorities for Gen Z. The stat is that there are 41 million of eligible Gen Z voters, which is an absolutely enormous block in the US. And so I'm curious what you see are the priorities. As a corollary of that question, we've seen increasing reporting. I find this really interesting. We see increasing reporting on a potential political divide for the first time within Gen Z. It's Gen Z women are going more to the left and Gen Z men are actually going more to the right. And so I'm curious if you've experienced any of this within your own district, things that you see even outside that makes it seem like Gen Z is less homogenous than perhaps people perceive them to be.
I always say, you do not need to choose one or the other, right? I think it is a false choice to say that we have to focus on the issues of younger generations or just on every other issue that we face. If you look at my legislative portfolio, yes, I'm working on student mental health and I'm working on keeping students safe in school and I'm working on some of these issues related to young people and the fentanyl overdose epidemic, but I'm also working on expanding the tax credit for seniors. And I'm working on investing in new innovative technology in our state, right? Like we can do both. It's just a matter of making sure that we're prioritizing both. We are a generation that is impatient and a generation that wants to see progress. We're also a very pragmatic generation, right? We know that we need solutions. Most of the young people that I speak to want something to get done. I ran for Congress in this primary, had a very intense congressional primary. We didn't win, but what we learned along the way was the importance of showing up and listening, in particular to young people, and breaking through some of the noise. I think everyone in this country right now is so sick and tired of the last 8 years of our politics. And I'm not blaming it on just one person. I think that there has just been so much intensity, so much division, and there is just so much exhaustion. And for young people in particular, that's the case. There still is a lot of hope and optimism and excitement, but a lot of people look at these two candidates and look at the political arena generally and say, why would I want anything to do with that, right? And I had an instance in particular where I was at an event. It was like pretty late at night and I was the one candidate in the room in a packed room of people. And I guess word had spread that I was there, that it was a Democratic state legislator running for Congress. And this young woman comes up from across the room and she walks right up to me and says, I hate Democrats and I hate politicians. And I said, oh, wow, this is going to be a really, really fun conversation.
Was it threatening? I'm like alarmed from that statement.
It was very clear to me that it came from a place of complete distrust. It wasn't like, I hate you, I'm in it, you know. No, it was like, what are you doing here, right? Like, why? And then we started talking and I asked why. And she said, all politicians, they don't live here. They don't understand me. They're all out of touch. They're all wealthy and they don't understand my reality. And I said, okay, like I'm a little different. And I started talking about who I am, why I'm in this. And then I said, forget about the politics, forget about the party. Tell me about the issues that you care about. And we started talking and she said, you know, I'm worried that there are attacks on my reproductive freedom. I'm worried that I can't afford the cost of housing anymore. It's just becoming so incredibly expensive. I'm frustrated that I can't have some form of public transportation to get to and from my job. And I don't really have good access to a car. And I'm really worried about the student debt that I still have and have really no way of paying off with this job that I love. And when I heard that, I was like, oh, okay. Like, let's be very clear here. I recognize each of those issues. I too have student debt that I'm dealing with. I too pay way too much in rent every single month. I understand what it's like to face frustration over public transportation. There is a party, right? There are people with certain values, me included, who are fighting for your right to make life better on all these different fronts that you talked about. We stop talking about the politics And we started talking about the actual solutions to the problems that she was facing and the fears that she had in her day-to-day life. She became one of the most active volunteers in our campaign, right? But think about that transition, right? We started with someone walking up and saying, I can't stand you, to someone saying, okay, I want to be part of this because this is different. This to me was one of those moments that I was like, okay, now I understand young voters and young people even more. I think that's the epitome of it. They don't want the toxic, divisive policies. They want solutions to the challenges we're facing.
I think that's very astute. And it's funny. I mean, a couple of things that you mentioned there. One, obviously, it's how you turn issues into solutions. I mean, honestly, it reminds me of what we try to provide for companies, our thesis around trust. And it's basically action earns trust, action drives trust. And it's exactly that. And, you know, whether that's applied to companies, whether that's applied to governments and politicians, it's exactly that. How do you show up for me? How do you make my life better? That is the sort of recipe. You know, how are you transparent? Do you share my values? These are sort of the underpinnings of trust. Again, whatever institution you are, whether you're a government, whether you're a business, it's all sort of the same. So we just launched a special report around elections and politics, not just in the US, although the US election is, of course, coming up very soon, but also because in this year, there are a number of elections around the world. So it's not just the US, it's a very global phenomenon. It was shocking on one hand, but not completely shocking on the other, is that Gen Z of all generations was the least trusting of electoral systems. So only 47% said they trusted electoral systems. Now, that's a global number. That's not just the US. But speaking to you now, I have to imagine that you're not very surprised by that. And so my question is, I mean, I think you've given some thoughts on why you think that's the case. So I'd love for you, if you have any, you know, additional builds on why you think that's the case, but more importantly, what you think the solution is here. And I think that's exactly it, is in the way that you sort of showed this woman the solutions to the problems that she was describing and that led to her trusting you and that led to her sort of changing her behavior and actions. What do you think that governments or other institutions or politicians can do to earn back that trust specifically from Gen Z?
I'll tell you first why I'm extremely worried about this. And it's something that I talk about a lot, that I was talking about a lot on the campaign trail. You know, my family's from Uruguay. I immigrated here when I was really young. And when I was in graduate school, actually, I had a professor who was an expert on the fall of Uruguayan democracy. When we started talking, she was telling me that, and this is something that I think we've seen globally as well, it's not just limited to Uruguay. It's that what happened in Uruguay, there was a coup when my parents were really young. There was a military dictatorship for 12 years. And what happened there was that you had an authoritarian force that started to gain ground. And that was met with very little resistance because you had a growing number of people who had just lost trust entirely in government and had lost faith in democracy. What's the point in me fighting for this democracy, fighting for government, if it's not really doing anything for me and if I can't trust it? And that is, I think, in a way, what we're seeing in the United States. Which is, yes, and this terrifies me, right? You have this growing fascist, authoritarian, autocratic movement that is coming up, and a growing number of people, in particular young people, that just have so much distrust of our government and look at government and look at democracy and do not see those dividends. They don't see it working. So when those forces converge, we have a real problem. So my focus has been on a number of things. One is demonstrating the dividends of democracy, showing people in this country, in particular young people, that democracy still delivers, that government still works, right? And demonstrating that in a very public way. But then, you know, there is a reason why people distrust government. People didn't just wake up overnight and say, you know what, that sucks, right? It's because of a number of different events and public demonstrations, things that politicians have done or that we've seen a number of politicians do that just really raise alarm. You look at folks who have spent 30 years in Congress. You look at folks that have just amassed extreme wealth while in positions of power. You have seen folks that get elected and immediately dismiss their constituents. The barriers to be able to access or communicate with your politicians at times feels insurmountable, right? Like you just can't get in touch with the people that you're literally paying to represent you in government. And the incompetence, I think, has really frustrated people too. This Congress that has been just beyond ineffective. If you acted like that in your day-to-day job, right, you would get fired. You would get, if you're not demonstrating that you can get anything done, you will get fired. And the idea that these people are just able to stay in positions of power while demonstrating no ability to actually get things done, I think has really frustrated an entire generation. You don't have to be progressive, moderate, conservative, anything to believe that. So that is why I think it's so important to elect politicians who, A, are going to show up, and B, who are going to have that sense of relatability and that actual desire to represent. And I think we need more of that.
I completely agree with what you've said. And actually, as part of the trust barometer, basically our two axes are ethics and competence. For a very, very long time, institutions like, for example, nonprofits were seen as highly ethical, maybe slightly less competent. Business, on the other hand, highly competent, but slightly less ethical. Now, for the first time, interestingly, business is viewed as more ethical and competent, particularly than government, which, based on what you're saying, I don't think should come as any surprise. But my question to you is, we have a lot of data that shows the general public respondents prefer when governments partner with business in order to affect changes. So I'm curious if this is something that you've seen across the board, and if there's any examples that you think are really relevant here, or anything that we can learn from why people enjoy and trust that partnership.
I focused on one thing in particular here, which is the role that business is going to play, that the private sector is going to play in addressing the climate crisis. Government has to have certain regulations to make sure that we are meeting our goals of decarbonization. You know, Maryland has a very bold plan when it comes to decarbonization and climate action generally. But I think about, there is a gap. Europe has demonstrated this, that you can do everything right, but there's still going to be a gap where you're going to need innovation and the private sector to help come up with those solutions that we're going to need to be able to fully decarbonize and fully adapt to climate change. I see that as, in my home state and in the United States, as not only something that is an urgent need, but also a tremendous economic opportunity. And so I've partnered with accelerators and businesses in the state of Maryland to make sure that they're getting the money that they need, the resources that they need from government to be able to grow. And I think there's a number of different ways for us to be able to continue generating those relationships and building on those relationships. But ultimately, right, I took a tour about a month ago at this point, of a bunch of these businesses, startups mostly, across the state. And the work that they are doing is unbelievable, unbelievable. And we are going to need the strategies and technologies and tools that they are coming up with to be able to decarbonize. So that relationship, they need government support, but we're going to need the entire country and the entire world's going to have to count on what they are doing. So I think that's an example of where government and the private sector are going to need to come together to really drive these solutions to save our planet.
So another question is, if you could give a piece of advice or a word to any Gen Zers who might be listening, thinking about getting involved in politics, what would it be?
I am a strong believer that this government and our democracy really belongs to all of us. And I've seen in my time in public office how I've been able to shape policy and really drive solutions to the challenges that we face, right? We were talking earlier about student mental health. One of the first bills that I was able to drive across the finish line as a legislator was intended to help recruit and retain more mental health professionals across our state. The work that I've been able to do on addressing the climate crisis, the work that I've been able to do addressing numerous of these challenges that we think of as young people every single day. I love being in a position to be able to drive some of these solutions and work with young people in doing that. Whether it's by running for office or whether it's just by advocating and being part of the solution, you can really drive the change. I still believe that government works. I still believe that democracy works. I still believe that if you make your voice heard, you can make a difference. It's just up to all of us to make our voices heard.
Well, that's all the time we have. Thank you, Joe, for your insights and expertise. And to our listeners, thank you for listening to The Trustmakers.
Thank you for tuning into The Trustmakers, an Edelman podcast in partnership with Advertising Week, where we speak with leaders and other trust builders across institutions. See you next time.